handbill under the door and go to the next place. When he had worked out Mason City, he went over to Tyree, the other town in the county, and passed out his bills the same way, and then he called on the Crossroads settlements. He didn't dent the constituency. The other fellow was elected. J.H. Moore built the schoolhouse, which began to need repairs before the paint was dry. Willie was out of a job. Pillsbury and his friends, no doubt, picked up some nice change as kickback from J.H. Moore and forgot about the whole business. At least they forgot about it for about 3 years, when their bad luck started. Meanwhile, Willie was back on Pappy's farm, helping with the chores and peddling a patent fix-it household kit around the country to pick up a little change, working from door to door again, going from settlement to settlement in his old car, and stopping at the farmhouses in between, knocking on the door and tipping his hat, and then showing the woman how to fix a pot. And at night he was plugging away at his books, getting ready for the bar examination. But before that came to pass, Willie and Lucy and I sat there that night in the parlor, and Willie said, "They tried to run it over me. They just figured I'd do anything they told me, and they tried to run it over me like I was dirt." And laying her sewing down in her lap, Lucy said, "Now, honey, you didn't want to be mixed up with them anyway. Not after you found out they were dishonest and crooked." "They tried to run it over me," he repeated sullenly, twisting his heavy body in the chair, "like I was dirt." "Willie," she said, leaning toward him a little, "they would have been crooks even if they didn't try to run it over you." He wasn't paying her much mind. "They'd be crooks, wouldn't they?" she asked in a tone which was a little bit like the patient leading them on tone she must have used in the schoolroom. She kept watching his face, which seemed to be pulling back from her and from me and the room, as though he weren't really hearing her voice, but were listening to another voice, a signal maybe, outside the house, in the dark beyond the screen of the open window. "Wouldn't they?" she asked him, pulling him back into the room, into the circle of soft light from the lamp on the table, where the big Bible and the plush-bound album lay. The bowl of the lamp was china and had a spray of violets painted on it. "Wouldn't they?" she asked him. And before he answered, I caught myself listening to the dry, compulsive, half-witted sound the crickets were making out in the grass in the dark. Then he said, Yeah, they be crooks all right," and heaved himself in the chair with the motion of one who is irritated at having a train of thought interrupted. Then he sank back into whatever he was brooding over. Lucy looked at me with a confident, bird-like lift of her head, as though she had proved something to me. The secondary glow of the light above the circle of light was on her face, and if I had wanted to, I could have guessed that some of that glow was given off softly by her face, as though the flesh had a delicate and unflagging and serene phosphorescence from its own inwardness. Well, Lucy was a woman, and therefore she must have been wonderful in the way women are wonderful. She turned her face to me with that expression which seemed to say, "See, I told you, that's the way it is." And meanwhile, Willie sat there. But his own face seemed to be pulling off again into the distance, which was not distance, but which was, shall I say, simply himself. Lucy was sewing now, and talking to me while looking down at the cloth, and after a little Willie got up and started to walk up and down the room, with his forelock coming down over his eyes. He kept on pacing back and forth while Lucy and I talked. It wasn't very soothing to have that going on across one end of the room. Finally, Lucy looked up from her sewing and said, "Honey?" Willie stopped pacing and swung his head at her with the forelock down over his eyes to give him the look of a mean horse when he's cornered in the angle of the pasture fence with his head down a little and the mane shagged forward between the ears and the eyes both wild and shrewd, watching you step up with the bridle and getting ready to bolt.
"Sit down, honey," Lucy said. "You make me nervous. You're just like Tommy. You can't ever sit still."
Then she laughed, and with a sort of shame-faced grin on his face, he came over and sat down. She was a fine woman, and he was lucky to have her. But he was also lucky to have the sheriff and Dolph Pillsbury, for they were doing him a favor and not knowing it. He didn't seem to know it either at the time, that they were his luck. But perhaps the essential part of him was knowing it all the time, only word hadn't quite got around to the other and accidental parts of him. Or it is possible that fellows like Willie Stark are born outside of luck, good or bad, and luck, which is what about makes you and me what we are, doesn't have anything to do with them, for they are what they are from the time they first kick in the womb until the end. And if that's the case, then their life history is a process of discovering what they really are, and not, as for you and me, sons of luck, a process of becoming what luck makes us. And if that is the case, then Lucy wasn't Willie's luck, or his unluck either. She was part of the climate in which the process of discovering the real Willie was taking place. But, speaking vulgarly, the sheriff and Pillsbury were part of Willie's luck. I didn't know it that night in Pappy's parlor, and I didn't know it when I got back to town and gave Jim Madison my tale. Well, Willie began to appear in the Chronicle in the role of the boy upon the burning deck, and the boy who put his finger in the dike, and the boy who replies, "I can," when duty whispers low, "Thou must." The Chronicle was turning up more and more tales about finagling in county courthouses around the state. It pointed the finger of fine scorn and reprobation all over the map. Then I began to grasp the significance of what was going on in that world of reasons high above the desk of Jim Madison, and caught the glint of those diaphanous spirit wings and the fluting whispers of the faint angel voices up there. In brief, this. The happy harmony in the state machine was a thing of the past, and the Chronicle was lined up with the soreheads and was hacking away at the county substructure of the machine. It was starting there, feeling its way, setting the stage and preparing the backdrop for the real show. It wasn't as hard as it might have been. Ordinarily, the country boys in the county courthouses have plenty of savvy and know all the tricks and are plenty hard to pin anything on. But the machine had been operating so long now without serious opposition that ease had corrupted them. They just didn't bother to be careful. So the Chronicle was making a good show. But Mason County was exhibit number one, on account of Willie. He gave the touch of drama to the sordid tale. He became symbolically the spokesman for the tongue-tied population of honest men. And when Willie was licked at the polls of Mason County, the Chronicle ran his picture, and under it the line, "Keeps his faith." And under that they printed the statement which Willie had given to me when I went back up to Mason City after the election and after Willie was out. The statement went like this. "Sure, they did it, and it was a clean job, which I admire. I'm going back to Pappy's farm and milk the cows and study some more law, for it looks like I'm going to need it. But I have kept my faith in the people of Mason County. Time will bring all things to light." I had gone up there to see what he had to say, but didn't have to go out to the farm. I ran into Willie on the street. He'd been building some fence and had busted his wire stretcher and had come into town to get a new one. He was wearing an old black felt hat and overalls which hung down around his can as though he were little droopy drawers smiling up from the playpen. We went to the drugstore and had a Coke. We stood in front of the soda fountain and I put my pad in front of Willie by his old hat and gave him a pencil. He licked the point and his eyes glazed as though he were getting ready to do sums on his slate, and then leaning up against the marble, with his overalls drooping, he wrote out the statement in his big, round, scrawly hand. "How's Lucy making out?" I asked him. "Fine," he said. "She likes it out there, and she's company for Pappy. It suits her all right." "That's fine," I said. "It suits me, too," he said, not looking at me, but across the fountain at his own face in the big mirror. "The way it is, it all suits me just fine," he said, and looked at the face in the mirror, which was freckled and thin-skinned over the full flesh, but under the shaggy forelock was untroubled and pure, like the face of a man who tops the last rise and looks down at the road running long and straight to the place where he is going. As I said, if a man like Willie can be said to live in the world of luck, Dolph Pillsbury and the sheriff were his luck. They ran it over, Willie, and got the new schoolhouse built by J.H. Moore. J.H. Moore used the brick out of the kiln owned by the distant relative of Pillsbury. It was just another big box of a schoolhouse with a fire escape at each end. The fire escapes weren't the kind which looks like a silo and which has a corkscrew-shaped chute inside for the kiddies to slide down. They were iron stairs attached to the outside of the building. There wasn't any fire at the schoolhouse. There was just a fire drill. About 2 years after the place was built, it happened. There was a fire drill, and all the kids on the top floor started to use the fire escapes. The first kids to start down on the fire escape at the west end were little kids, and they couldn't get down the steps very fast. Right after them came a batch of big kids, 7th and 8th graders. Because the little kids held up the traffic, the fire escape and the iron platform at the top got packed with kids. Well, some of the brickwork gave, and the bolts and bars holding the contraption to the wall pulled loose, and the whole thing fell away, spraying kids in all directions. 3 kids were killed outright. They were the ones that hit the concrete walk. About 12 were crippled up pretty seriously, and several of those never were much good afterward. It was a piece of luck for Willie. Willie didn't try to cash in on the luck. He didn't have to try. People got the point. Willie went to the triple funeral the town had for the kids who got killed and stood modestly in the background. But old Mr. Sandine, who was father of one of the dead kids, saw him back in the crowd, and while the clods were still bouncing off the coffin lids, Mr. Sandine pushed back to him and grabbed him by the hand and lifted up one arm above his head and said loud, "Oh, God, I am punished for accepting iniquity and voting against an honest man." It brought down the house. Some women began to cry. Then other people began to come up and grab Willie by the hand. Pretty soon there was scarcely a dry eye in the crowd. Willie's weren't dry either. It was Willie's luck, but the best luck always happens to people who don't need it. He had Mason County in the palm of his hand, and in the city his picture was in all the papers. But he didn't run for anything. He kept on working on his father's farm and studying his law books at night. The only thing he did about politics was to get out and make some speeches for a fellow who was running in the primary against the congressman who had always been a pal of Pillsbury. Willie's speeches weren't any good, at least the one I heard wasn't any good. But they didn't have to be good. People didn't bother to listen to them. They just came to look at Willie and clap and then go vote against the Pillsbury man. Then one day Willie woke up and found himself running for governor. Or rather, he was running in the Democratic primary, which in our state is the same as running for governor. Now, it wasn't any particular achievement to be running in the primary. Anybody who can scrape together a few dollars for the qualifying fee can offer for election and have the pleasure of seeing his name printed on the ballot. But Willie's case was a little different. There were then 2 major factions in the Democratic Party in the state, the Joe Harrison outfit and the McMurphy outfit. Harrison had been governor some time back, and McMurphy was in then and was going to try to hold the job. Harrison was a city man, and practically all of his backing was city backing. McMurphy wasn't exactly a hick, having been born and bred in Dubois-ville, which is a pretty fair-sized place, maybe 90,000, but he had a lot of country backing and small-town backing. He had played pretty smart with the Cockleburr vote and mostly had it. It was due to be a close race. That situation was what got Willie into the show. Somebody in the Harrison outfit got the idea, which God knows he didn't invent, of putting in a dummy who might split the McMurphy vote. This had to be somebody who had a strong appeal in the country, so that was Willie, who could throw some weight up in the north end of the state. There wasn't any deal with Willie. It developed. Some gentlemen from the city called on him up in Mason City, driving up there in a fine car and striped pants. One of them was Mr. Duffy, Tiny Duffy, who was a lot grander now than he had been back that day when he and Willie had first met in the back room of Slade's beer parlor. The gentleman from the city persuaded Willie that he was the savior of the state, I suppose that Willie had his natural quota of ordinary suspicion and caginess, but those things tend to evaporate when what people tell you is what you want to hear. Also, there was the small matter of God. People said that God had taken a hand in the schoolhouse business, that God had stepped in on Willie's side, the Lord had justified him. Willie was not religious by any ordinary standards, but the schoolhouse business very probably gave him the notion, which was shared by a lot of the local citizenry, that he stood in a special relation to God, destiny, or plain luck. And it doesn't matter what you call it or if you go to church. And since the Lord moves in a mysterious way, it should not have surprised Willie that he was using some fat man in striped pants and a big car to work his will. The Lord was calling Willie, and Tiny Duffy was just an expensively dressed Western Union boy in a Cadillac instead of on a bicycle. So Willie signed the receipt. Willie was ready to ride. He was a lawyer now. He'd been for some little time, for after he had lost out as county treasurer, he had buckled down to his books pretty seriously in what time he could spare from farming and peddling his fix-it household kit. He had sat up there in his room late at night in summer, dog sleepy but grinding his eyes into the page, while the moths tapped and blurred at the window screen and tried to get onto the flame of the oil lamp, which sizzled softly on his table. Or he had sat up there on winter nights, while the fire died out in the rusty trash burner stove, and the wind beat on the north side of the house, coming down 1,000 miles through the night to shake the room where Willie sat hunched over the book. Long back, he had spent a year at the Baptist College over at Marston, in the next county, long back before he'd met Lucy. The college wasn't much more than a glorified grade school, but there he had heard the big names written on the big books. He had left the college with the big names in his head because he didn't have any money. Then the war had come and he had been in it, stuck off somewhere in Oklahoma in a camp, feeling cheated somehow and feeling that he had missed his chance. Then after the war there had been the working on his father's place and reading books at night, not law books, just what books he could get hold of. He wanted to know the history of the country. He had a college textbook, a big thick one. Years later, showing it to me, he prodded it with his finger and said, "I'd darn near memorize every darn word in it. I could name you every name. I could name you every date." Then he prodded it again, this time contemptuously, and said, "And the fella that wrote it didn't know a goddamn thing about how things were. He didn't know a thing. I bet things are just like they are now. A lot of folks wrestling around." But there had been the great names, too. There had been a notebook, a big cloth-bound ledger, in which he wrote the fine sayings and the fine ideas he got out of the books. A long time later he showed me that, too, and as I thumbed idly through it, noticing the quotations from Emerson and Macaulay and Benjamin Franklin and Shakespeare copied out in a ragged boyish hand, he said with that same tone of amiable contempt, "Gee, back in those days I figured those fellas who wrote the books knew all there was. And I figured I was going to get me a chunk of it. Yeah, I figured I'd sweat for me a chunk of it." He laughed and added, "Yeah, I thought I was the nuts." He had been going to get a chunk of all there was. But in the end it was a chunk of law. Lucy came into the picture and then the kid, Tom, and there was working and later the courthouse. But in the end, he got a chunk of law. An old lawyer over at Tyree helped him, lending him books and answering questions. There'd been about 3 years of that. If he'd just been trying to squeeze by the bar with as little as possible, he could have done it a lot sooner, for back in those days, or now for that matter, it didn't take any mastermind to pass the bar examination. "I sure was a fool," Willie said to me once, talking about those times. "I thought you had really to learn all that stuff. I thought they meant for you to learn law. Hell, I got down to that bar examination, I looked at the questions, I nearly busted out laughing. Me sitting up there bearing down on those books, and then they gave me those little crappy questions. A cornfield nigger could have answered them if he'd been able to spell. I ought to have looked twice at some of the lawyers I'd seen, and I'd have known a halfwit could pass it. But oh no, I was hell-bent on learning me some law." Then he laughed, stopped laughing, and said with a touch of the grimness which must have belonged to the long nights up there in his room, when he had bent over the trash burner or heard the moths batting soft at the screen in the August dark, "Well, I learned me some law. I could wait." He could wait. He had read the books the old lawyer over at Tyree had, and then he bought new books, sending away for them with the money he grubbed out of the ground or got with his patented fix-it household kit. The time came in the end, and he put on his good suit, blue serge and slick in the seat, and caught the train down to the city to take the examination. He had waited, and now he really knew what was in the books. He was a lawyer now. He could hang the overalls on a nail and let them stiffen with the last sweat he had sweated into them. He could rent himself a room over the dry goods store in Mason City and call it his office, and wait for somebody to come up the stairs where it was so dark you had to feel your way, and where it smelled like the inside of an old trunk that's been in the attic 20 years. He was a lawyer now, and it had taken him a long time. It had taken him a long time because he had had to be a lawyer on his terms and in his own way. But that was over. But maybe it had taken him too long. If something takes too long, something happens to you. You become all and only the thing you want and nothing else, for you have paid too much for it, too much in wanting and too much in waiting and too much in getting. In the end, they just ask you those crappy little questions. But the wanting and the waiting were over now, and Willie had a haircut and a new hat and a new briefcase with the copy of his speech in it, which he had written out in longhand and had said to Lucy with gestures, as though he were getting ready for the high school oratorical contest, and a lot of new friends, with drooping blue jowls and sharp pale noses, who slapped him on the back, and a campaign manager, Tiny Duffy, who would introduce him to you and say with a tin-glittering heartiness, "Meet Willie Stark, the next governor of this state." And Willie would put out his hand to you with the gravity of a bishop, for he never tumbled to a thing. I used to wonder how he got that way. If he'd been running for something back in Mason County, he never in God's world would have been that way. He would have taken a perfectly realistic view of things and counted up his chances. Or if he'd got into the gubernatorial primary on his own hook, he would have taken a realistic view, but this was different. He had been called. He had been touched. He had been summoned. And he was a little bit awestruck by the fact. It seems incredible that he hadn't taken one look at Tiny Duffy and his friends and realized that things might not be absolutely on the level. But actually, as I figured it, it wasn't incredible. For the voice of Tiny Duffy summoning him was nothing but the echo of a certainty and a blind compulsion within him, the thing that had made him sit up in his room night after night, rubbing the sleep out of his eyes to write the fine phrases and the fine ideas in the big ledger, or to bend with a violent, almost physical intensity over the yellow page of an old law book. For him to deny the voice of Tiny Duffy would have been as difficult as for a saint to deny the voice that calls in the night. He wasn't really in touch with the world. He was not only bemused by the voice he had heard, he was bemused by the very grandeur of the position to which he aspired. The blaze of light hitting him in the eyes blinded him. After all, he had just come out of the dark, the period when he grubbed on the farm all day and didn't see anybody but the family, and day after day he must have moved by them as though they weren't half real, and sat at night in his room with the books and hurt inside with the effort and the groping and the wanting. So it isn't much wonder that the blaze of light blinded him. He knew something about human nature, all right. He'd sat around the county courthouse long enough to find out something. True, he had got himself thrown out of the courthouse, but that wasn't ignorance of human nature. It was, perhaps, a knowledge not of human nature in general, but of his own nature in particular, something deeper than the mere question of right and wrong. He became a martyr, not through ignorance, not only for the right, but also for some knowledge of himself deeper than right or wrong. He knew something about human nature, but something now came between him and that knowledge. In a way, he flattered human nature. He assumed that other people were as bemused by the grandeur and as blinded by the light of the post to which he aspired, and that they would only listen to argument and language that was grand and bright. So his speeches were cut to that measure. It was a weird mixture of facts and figures on one hand, his tax program, his road program, and of fine sentiments on the other hand, a faint echo somewhat dulled by time of the quotations copied out in the ragged boyish hand in the big ledger. Willie went around the country in a good second-hand automobile, which had been bought on the 18 payment plan, and saw his face on the posters nailed to telephone poles and corn cribs and board fences. He'd get to town, and after he'd been to the post office to see if there was a letter from Lucy, and after he had had a session with the local politicos and done some handshaking, he wasn't too hot at that, too much talk about principles and not enough about promises. He would hole up in a hotel room, $2 without bath, and work some more on his speech. He kept on polishing and revising the damn thing. He was hell-bent on making each one a second Gettysburg address. And maybe after he had tinkered with it a while, he would get up and start pacing in his room. He would pace and pace, and pretty soon he'd start to say his speech. If you were in the next room, you could hear him pacing and speeching, and when he stopped pacing, you knew he had stopped in front of the mirror to polish up a gesture. And sometimes I'd be in the next room, for I was supposed to cover his campaign for the Chronicle. I'd be lying there in the hole in the middle of my bed, where the springs had given down with the weight of wayfaring humanity, lying there on my back with my clothes on, and looking up at the ceiling, and watching the cigarette smoke flow up slow and splash against the ceiling, like the upside-down, slow-motion moving picture of the ghost of a waterfall, or like the pale, uncertain spirit rising up out of your mouth on the last exhalation, the way the Egyptians figured it, to leave the horizontal tenement of clay in its ill-fitting pants and vest. I'd be lying there, letting the smoke drift up out of my mouth and not feeling anything, just watching the smoke as though I didn't have any past or future, and suddenly Willie would start in the next room, tramping and mumbling. It would be a reproach, an affront, a cause for laughter and a thing for tears. Knowing what you knew, you would lie there listening to him getting ready to be governor, and want to stuff the pillow slip in your mouth to stop the giggles. The poor half-witted bastard in his speech. But the voice would keep on going over there beyond the wall, and the feet would keep on tramping back and forth like the feet of a heavy animal, prowling and swinging back and forth with a heavy swaying head in a locked-up room, or a cage, hunting for the place to get out, not giving up and irreconcilably and savagely sure that there was going to be a loose board or bar or latch sometime, not now, but sometime. And listening to it, you wouldn't be so sure for a minute the bar or board would hold, or the feet would not stop, and they were like a machine, which was not human or animal either, and were tramping on you like pestles or plungers in a big vat, and you were the thing in the vat, the thing that just happened to be there. The plungers didn't care about its being you or not being you in the vat, but they would continue until there wasn't any you, and afterward, for a long time, until the machine wore out or somebody switched off the juice.
This ends Disc 3. All the King's Men, Disc 4.
Then, because you want to lie down in the late afternoon, on a strange bed in a shadowy room, and watch the smoke drift up and not think about anything, what you've been or what you're going to be, and because the feet, the beast, the plungers, the half-wit won't stop, you jerk yourself up and sit on the edge of the bed and feel like swearing. But you don't. For you are wondering, with the beginnings of pain and insufficiency, what it is inside that won't let the feet stop. Maybe he is a half-wit. Maybe he won't be governor. Maybe nobody will listen to his speeches but Lucy. But the feet won't stop. Nobody would listen to the speeches, including me. They were awful. They were full of facts and figures he had dug up about running the state. He would say, "Now, friends, if you will bear patiently with me for a few minutes, I'll give you the figures." And he would clear his throat and fumble with a sheet of paper, and backbones would sag lower in the seats and folks would start cleaning their fingernails with their pocket knives. If Willie had ever thought of talking to folks up on the platform just the way he could talk to you face to face when he got heated about something, leaning at you as if he meant every damned word he said and his eyes bugging out and shining, he might have swayed the constituency, but no, he was trying to live up to his notion of a high destiny. It didn't matter so much as long as Willie was playing the local circuit. The carryover of the schoolhouse episode was still strong enough to mean something. He was the fellow on the Lord's side, and the Lord had given a sign. The Lord had knocked over the fire escape just to prove a point. But when Willie got down in the middle of the state, he began to run into trouble. And when he hit a town of any size, he found out that the folks didn't care much which side of a question was the Lord's side. Willie knew what was happening, but he didn't know why. His face got a little thinner, and the thin skin seemed to draw back tighter over the flesh, but he didn't look worried. That was the funny part. If ever a man had a right to look worried, it was Willie. But he didn't. He just looked like a man in a kind of waking dream, and when he walked out on the platform before he began talking, his face looked purified and lifted up and serene, like the face of a man who has just pulled out of a hard sickness. But he hadn't pulled out of the sickness he had. He had galloping political anemia. He couldn't figure out what was wrong. He was like a man with a chill who simply reckons that the climate is changing all of a sudden and wonders why everybody else isn't shivering too. Perhaps it was a desire for just a little human warmth that got him in the habit of dropping into my room late at night after the speaking and the handshaking were over. He would sit for a spell while I drank off my nightcap and not talk much, but one time, at Morristown, where the occasion had sure God been a black frost, he did, after sitting quiet, suddenly say, "How you think it's going, Jack?" It was one of those embarrassing questions like, "Do you think my wife is virtuous? Or did you know I'm a Jew?" which are embarrassing not because of anything you might say for an answer, the truth or a lie, but because the fellow asked the question at all. But I said to him, "Fine, I reckon it's going fine." "You think so, for a fact?" he asked. "Sure," I said. He chewed that for about a minute and then swallowed it. Then he said, "They didn't seem to be paying attention much tonight, not while I was trying to explain about my tax program." "Maybe you try to tell them too much. It breaks down their brain cells." "Looks like they'd want to hear about taxes, though," he said. "You tell them too much. Just tell them you're going to soak the fat boys and forget the rest of the tax stuff." "What we need is a balanced tax program. Right now, the ratio between income tax and total income for the state gives an index that..." "Yeah," I said, "I heard the speech, but they don't give a damn about that. Hell, make them cry, make them laugh, make them think you're their weak, erring pal, or make them think you're God Almighty, or make them mad, even mad at you. Just stir them up, it doesn't matter how or why, and they'll love you and come back for more. Pinch them in the soft place. They aren't alive, most of them, and haven't been alive in 20 years. Hell, their wives have lost their teeth and their shape, and liquor won't set on their stomachs, and they don't believe in God, so it's up to you to give them something to stir them up and make them feel alive again. Just for half an hour. That's what they come for. Tell them anything. But for sweet Jesus' sake, don't try to improve their minds." I fell back exhausted, and Willie pondered that for a while. He just sat there, not moving and with his face quiet and pure. But you had the feeling that if you listened close enough, you would hear the feet tramping inside his head, that something was locked up in there and going back and forth. Then he said soberly, "Yeah, I know that's what some folks say." "You weren't born yesterday," I said, and was suddenly angry with him. "You weren't deaf and dumb all the time you had the job in the courthouse in Mason City, even if you did get in because Pillsbury put you there." He nodded. "Yeah," he said. "I heard that kind of talk." "It gets around," I said. "It's not any secret." Then he demanded, "Do you think it's true?" "True?" I echoed, and almost asked myself the question before I said, "Hell, I don't know, but there's sure a lot of evidence." He sat there a minute longer, then got up and said good night and went to his room. It wasn't long before I heard the pacing start. I got undressed and lay down, but the pacing kept on. Old Mastermind lay there and listened to the pacing in the next room and said, "The bastard is trying to think up a joke he can tell him at Skidmore tomorrow night and make him laugh." Old Mastermind was right. The candidate did tell a joke at Skidmore, but it didn't make him laugh. But it was at Skidmore that I was sitting in a booth in a Greek cafe after the speaking, having a cup of coffee to steady my nerves and hiding out from people and the cackle of voices and the smell of bodies and the way eyes look at you in a crowd, when in came Sadie Burke and gave the joint the once-over and caught sight of me and came back and sat down across from me in the booth. Sadie was one of Willie's new friends, but I had known her from way back. She was an even better friend, rumor had it, of a certain Sen-Sen Puckett, who chewed Sen-Sen to keep his breath sweet and was a fat boy, both physically and politically speaking, and had been, and probably still was, a friend of Joe Harrison. Sen-Sen, according to some guesses, was the fellow who originally had had the bright idea of using Willie as the dummy. Sadie was a lot too good for Sen-Sen, who wasn't, however, a bad-looking fellow. Sadie herself wouldn't have been called good-looking, certainly not by the juries who pick out girls to be Miss Oregon and Miss New Jersey. She was built very satisfactorily, but you tended to forget that, because of the awful clothes she wore and the awkward, violent, snatching gestures she made. She had absolutely black hair, which she cut off at a crazy length and which went out in all directions in a wild, electric way. Her features were good, if you noticed them, which you were inclined not to do because her face was pocked. But she did have wonderful eyes, deep-set and inky, velvety black. Sadie wasn't, however, too good for Sen-Sen because of her looks. She was too good for him because he was a heel. She had probably taken him up because he was good-looking, and then, again according to rumor, she had put him into political pay dirt. For Sadie was a very smart cookie. She had been around, and she had learned a lot the very hard way. She was in Skidmore with the Stark party that time because she was attached to the Stark headquarters troop, probably as a kind of spy for Sen-Sen, and in some such ambiguous role as secretary. As a matter of fact, she was around a lot and made a good many of the arrangements and tipped off Willie about local celebrities. Well, now she came up to my booth in the Greek restaurant with that violent stride which was characteristic of her and looked down at me and demanded, "Can I sit with you?" She sat down before I could reply. "Or anything else," I replied gallantly. "Stand, sit, or lie." She inspected me critically out of her inky, velvety, black, deep-set eyes, which glittered in the marred face, and shook her head. "No, thanks," she said. "I like mine with vitamins." "You mean you don't think I'm handsome?" I demanded. "I don't care about anybody being handsome," she said. "But I never did go for anybody that reminded me of a box of spilled spaghetti, all elbows and dry rattle." "All right," I said. "I withdraw my proposal, with dignity. But tell me something, now that you mention vitamins. You figure your candidate Willie has any vitamins? For the constituency?" "Oh, God," she whispered and rolled her eyes to heaven. "All right," I said. "When are you going to tell the boys back home it's no go?" "What do you mean, no go? They're planning on a big barbecue and rally at Upton. Duffy told me so." "Sadie," I said, "you know damn well they'd have to barbecue the great woolly mastodon and use $10 bills instead of lettuce on the buns. Why don't you tell the big boys it's no go?" "What put that in your head?" "Listen, Sadie," I said, "we've been pals for a long time, and you needn't lie to Uncle. I don't put everything I know in the papers, but I know that Willie isn't in this race because you admire his oratory." "Ain't it awful?" she demanded. "I know it's a frame-up," I said. "Everybody knows but Willie." "All right," she admitted. "When are you going to tell the boys back home it's no go, that they're wasting dough? That Willie couldn't steal a vote from Abe Lincoln in the cradle of the Confederacy?" "I ought to have done it long ago," she said. "When are you going to?" I asked. "Listen," she said. "I told them before this thing ever started it was no go. But they wouldn't listen to Sadie, those fat heads. And she suddenly spewed out a mouthful of cigarette smoke over the rounded, too red, suddenly out-curling and gleaming underlip. Why don't you tell them it's no go and get the poor bastard out of his agony? Let them spend their goddamn money, she said fretfully, twitching her head as though to get the cigarette smoke out of her eyes. I wish they were spending a lot more, the fatheads. I wish the poor bastard had had enough sense to make them grease him good to take the beating he's in for. Now all he'll get will be the ride. Might as well let him have that. Ignorance is bliss. The waitress brought a cup of coffee, which Sadie must have ordered when she came in before she spotted me. She took a drag of the coffee, and then a deep drag of the cigarette. You know, she said, jabbing out the butt savagely in the cup and looking at it and not at me. You know, even if somebody told him, even if he found out he was a sucker, I believe he might keep right on. Yeah, I said, making those speeches. God, she said, aren't they awful? Yeah, but I believe he might keep right on, she said. Yeah, the sap, she said. We walked back to the hotel, and I didn't see Sadie again, except once or twice to say howdy-do to, until Upton. Things hadn't improved any before Upton. I went back to town and left the candidate to his own devices for a week or so in between, but I heard the news. Then I got the train over to Upton the day before the barbecue. Upton is way over in the western part of the state, the capital of the Cockleburr vote, which was supposed to come pelting out of the brush to the barbecue. And just a little way north of Upton there was a coal pocket, where a lot of folks lived in company shacks and prayed for a full week's work. It was a good location to get a sell-out house for the barbecue. Those folks in the shacks were in such a shape they'd be ready to walk 15 miles for a bait of fresh. If they still had the strength, and it was free. The local I rode puffed and yanked and stalled and yawned across the cotton country. We'd stop on a siding for half an hour waiting for something, and I watched the cotton rows converging into the simmering horizon, and a black stub of a burnt tree in the middle distance standing up out of the cotton rows. Then, late in the afternoon, the train headed into the cut-over pine and sagebrush. We would stop beside some yellow, box-like station, with the unpainted houses dropped down beyond, and I could see up the alley behind the downtown, and then, as the train pulled out again, across the backyards of houses surrounded by board or wire fences, as though to keep out the openness of the humped and sage-furred country, which seemed ready to slide in and eat up the houses. The houses didn't look as though they belonged there, improvised, flung down, ready to be abandoned. Some washing would be hanging on a line, but the people would go off and leave that, too. They wouldn't have time to snatch it off the line. It would be getting dark soon, and they'd better hurry. But as the train pulls away, a woman comes to the back door of one of the houses. Just the figure of a woman, for you can't make out the face. And she has a pan in her hands, and she flings the water out of the pan to make a sudden, tattered flash of silver in the light. She goes back into the house, to what is in the house. The floor of the house is thin against the bare ground, and the walls and the roof are thin against all of everything which is outside. But you can't see through the walls to the secret to which the woman has gone in. The train pulls away faster now, and the woman is back there in the house where she's going to stay. She'll stay there. And all at once you think that you are the one who is running away, and who had better run fast to wherever you are going because it will be dark soon. The train is going pretty fast now, but its effort seems to be through a stubborn, cloying density of air, as though an eel tried to swim in syrup, or the effort seems to be against an increasing and implacable magnetism of earth. You think that if the earth should twitch once, as the hide of a sleeping dog twitches, the train would be jerked over and piled up, and the engine would spew and gasp while somewhere a canted-up wheel would revolve once with a massive and dreamlike deliberation. But nothing happens. And you remember that the woman had not even looked up at the train. You forget her, and the train goes fast and is going fast when it crosses a little trestle. You catch the sober, metallic, pure, late light, unriffled glint of the water between the little banks under the sky, and you see the cow standing in the water upstream near the single leaning willow. And all at once you feel like crying. but the train is going fast, and almost immediately whatever you feel is taken away from you, too. You bloody fool, do you think you want to milk a cow? You don't want to milk a cow. Then you're at Upton. In Upton, I went to the hotel, toting my little bag and my typewriter through the gangs of people on the street, people who looked at me with a countryman's slow, full, curious lack of shame, and didn't make room for me to pass until I was charging them down, the way a cow won't get out of the way of your car in a lane until your radiator damn near bats her in the underslung slats. At the hotel, I ate a sandwich and went up to my room, and got the fan turned on and a pitcher of ice water sent up, and took off my shoes and shirt and propped myself in a chair with a book. At 10:30, there was a knock on the door. I yelled, and in came Willie. "Where you been?" I asked him. "Been here all afternoon," he said. "Duffy been dragging you around to shake hands with all the leading citizens?" "Yeah," he said glumly. The glumness in his voice made me look sharply at him. "What's the matter?" I asked. "Don't the boys around here talk nice to you?" "Sure, they talk all right," he said. He came over and took a chair by the writing table. He poured some water into one of the glasses on the tray beside my bottle of Red Eye, drank it, and repeated, "Yeah, they talk all right." I looked at him again. The face was thinner and the skin was pulled back tighter so that it looked almost transparent under the clusters of freckles. He sat there heavily, not paying any attention to me, as though he were mumbling something over and over in his mind. "What's eating you?" I asked. For a moment he didn't act as if he had heard me, and when he did turn his head to me, there seemed to be no connection between the act and what I had said. The act seemed to come from what was going on inside his head and not because I had spoken. "A man don't have to be governor," he said. "Huh?" I responded in my surprise, for that was the last thing I ever expected out of Willie by that time. The showing in the last town, where I hadn't been, must have been a real frost to wake him up. "A man don't have to be governor," he repeated. And as I looked at his face now, I didn't see the thin-skinned, boyish face, but another face under it, as though the first face were a mask of glass, and now I could see through it to the other one. I looked at the second face and saw, all of a sudden, the heavyish lips laid together to remind you of masonry, and the knot of muscle on each cheek back where the jawbone hinges on. "Well," I replied belatedly, "the votes haven't been counted yet." He mumbled over in his mind what he had been working on. Then he said, "I'm not denying I wanted it. I won't lie to you," he said, and leaned forward a little and looked at me as though he were trying to convince me of the thing which I was already surer of than I was of hands and feet. "I wanted it. I lay awake at night just wanting it." He worked his big hands on his knees, making the knuckles crack. "Hell, a man can lie there and want something so bad and be so full of wanting it, he just plain forgets what it is he wants. Just like when you're a boy and the sap first rises and you think you go crazy some night wanting something, and you want it so bad and get so near sick wanting it, you near forget what it is. It's something inside you." He leaned at me with his eyes on my face and grabbed the front of his sweat-streaked blue shirt to make me think he was going to snatch the buttons loose to show me something. But he subsided back in the chair, letting his eyes leave me to look across the wall as though the wall weren't there, and said, "But wantin' don't make a thing true. You don't have to live forever to figure that out." That was so true, I didn't reckon it was worthwhile even to agree with him. He didn't seem to notice my silence. He was so wrapped up in his own. But after a minute, he pulled out of it, stared at me, and said, "I could have made a good governor. By God..." And he struck his knees with his fist. "By God, a lot better than those fellas. Look here." And he leaned at me. "What the estate needs is a new tax program. And the rate ought to be raised on the coal lands the state's got leased out. And there's not a decent road in the state once you get in the country. And I could save this state some money by merging some departments. And schools, look at me, I never had a decent day schooling in my life. What I got, I dug out, and there's no reason why this state... I had heard it all before. On the platform when he stood up there high and pure in the face, and nobody gave a damn. He must have noticed that I wasn't giving a damn. He shut up all of a sudden. He got up and walked across the floor and back, his head thrust forward and the forelock falling over his brow. He stopped in front of me. "Those things need doing, don't they?" he demanded. "Sure," I said, and it was no lie. "But they won't listen to it," he said. "God damn those bastards," he said. "They come out to hear us speaking, and then they won't listen to you. Not a word. They don't care. God damn them. They deserve to grabble in the dirt and get nothing for it but a dry gut rumble. They won't listen." "No," I agreed. "They won't. And I won't be governor," he said shortly. "And they deserve what they get." And added, "The bastards." "Well, you want me to hold your hand about it?" Suddenly, I was sore at him. Why'd he come to me? What did he expect me to do? What made him think I wanted to hear about what the state needed? Hell, I knew. Everybody knew. It wasn't any secret. What it needed was some decent government. But who the hell was going to give it? And who cared if nobody did or ever did? What did he come whining to me for about that? Or about how bleeding much he wanted to be governor because he lay and thought about it in the night? All that was in me as I suddenly felt sore at him and asked him snottily if he expected me to hold his hand. He looked at me slowly, giving me the once-over, reading my face. But he didn't look sore, which surprised me, for I had wanted to make him sore, sore enough to get out. But there wasn't even surprise in his look. "No, Jack," he finally said, shaking his head. "I wasn't asking you for sympathy. Whatever happens, I'm not asking you or anybody else for sympathy." He shook himself heavily like a big dog coming out of the wet or waking up. "No, by God," he said, and he wasn't really talking to me now. "I'm not asking anybody in the world for it, not now or ever." That seemed to settle something, so he sat down again. "What are you going to do?" I asked. "I got to think," he replied. "I don't know, and I got to think. The bastards," he said. "If I could just make them listen." It was just at that time Sadie came in, or rather she knocked at the door, and I yelled, and she came in. "Hello," she said, gave a quick look at the scene, and started toward us. Her eye was on the bottle of red eye on my table. "How about some refreshment?" she said. "All right," I replied, but apparently I didn't get the right amount of joviality into my tone. Or maybe she could tell something had been going on from the way the air smelled, and if anybody could do that, it would be Sadie. Anyway, she stopped in the middle of the floor and said, "What's up?" I didn't answer right away, and she came across to the writing table, moving quick and nervous the way she always did, inside of a shapeless, shoddy blue summer suit that she must have got by walking into a second-hand store and shutting her eyes and pointing and saying, "I'll take that." She reached down and took a cigarette out of my pack lying there and tapped it on the back of her knuckles and turned her hot lamps on me. "Nothing," I said, "except Willie here is saying how he's not going to be governor." She had the match lighted by the time I got the words out, but it never got to the cigarette. It stopped in midair.
"So you told him,"
she said, looking at me. "The hell I did," I said. "I never tell anybody anything. I just listen." She snapped the match out with a nasty snatch of her wrist and turned on Willie.
"Who told you?" she demanded.
"Told me what?" Willie asked, looking up at her steady. She saw that she had made her mistake. And it was not the kind of mistake for Sadie Burke to make. She made her way in the world up from the shack and the mud flat by always finding out what you knew and never letting you know what she knew. Her style was not to lead with the chin, but with a neat length of lead pipe after you had stepped off balance. But she had led with the chin this time. Somewhere way back inside of Sadie Burke there had been the idea that I was going to tell Willie, or that somebody was going to tell Willie. Not that she, Sadie Burke, would tell Willie, but that Willie would be told and Sadie Burke wouldn't have to. Or nothing as specific as that. Just floating around in the deep dark, the idea of Willie and the idea of the thing Willie didn't know, like two bits of drift sucked down in an eddy to the bottom of the river to revolve slowly and blindly there in the dark. But there, all the time. So out of an assumption she had made, without knowing it, or a wish or a fear she didn't know she had, she led with her chin. And standing there, rolling that unlighted cigarette in her strong fingers, she knew it. The nickel was in the slot, and looking at Willie, you could see the wheels and the cogs and the cherries and the lemons begin to spin inside the machine. "Told me what?" Willie said. "Again." "That you're not going to be the governor," she said, with a dash of easy levity. But she flashed me a look, the only SOS, I suppose, Sadie Burke ever sent out to anybody. But it was her fudge, and I let her cook it. Willie kept on looking at her, waiting while she turned to one side and uncorked my bottle and poured herself out a steadier. She took it, and without any ladylike cough. "Told me what?" Willie said. She didn't answer. She just looked at him. And looking right back at her, he said in a voice like death and taxes, "Told me what?" "God damn you!" She blazed at him then, and the glass rattled on the tray as she set it down without looking. "You goddamn sap!" "All right," Willie said in the same voice, boring in like a boxer when the other fella begins to swing wild. "What was it?"
"All right," she said. "All right, you sap. You've been framed."
He looked at her steady for 30 seconds, and there wasn't a sound but the sound of his breathing. I was listening to it. Then he said,
"Framed."
"And how?" Sadie said, and leaned toward him with what seemed to be a vindictive and triumphant intensity glittering in her eyes and ringing in her voice.
"Oh, you decoy, you wooden-headed decoy, you let him. Oh, yeah, you let him because you thought you were the little white lamb of God."
And she paused to give him a couple of pitiful, derisive bahs, twisting her mouth.
"Yeah, you thought you were the lamb of God, all right, but you know what you are?"
She waited as though for an answer, but he kept staring at her without a word.
"Well, you're the goat," she said. "You are the sacrificial goat. You are the ram in the bushes. You are a sap, for you let them. You didn't even get anything out of it. They'd have paid you to take the rap, but they didn't have to pay a sap like you. Oh, no, you were so full of yourself and hot air and how you are Jesus Christ that all you wanted was a chance to stand on your hind legs and make a speech. My friends," she twisted her mouth in a nasty, simpering mimicry, "my friends, what this state needs is a good 5-cent cigar. Oh, my God."
And she laughed with a kind of wild, artificial laugh, suddenly cut short. "Why?" he demanded, still staring steadily at her, breathing hard but not showing anything. "Why did they do it? To me?"
"Oh, my God!" she exclaimed and turned to me. "Listen to the sap. He wants to know why."
Then she swung to him again, leaning closer, saying,
"Listen, if you can get this through your thick head, they wanted you to split the McMurphy vote in the sticks. Do you get that, or do you want a picture? Can you get that straight, you wooden head?"
He looked at me, slow, wet his lips, and then said, "Is it true?"
"He wants to know if it's true," Sadie announced prayerfully to the ceiling. "Oh, my God!"
"Is it true?" he asked me. "That's what they tell me," I said. Well, it hit him. There was no denying it. His face worked as though he might try to say something or might bust out crying. But he didn't do either one. He reached over to the table and picked up the bottle and poured out enough into a glass to floor the Irish and drank it off neat. Hey, I said, take it easy. You aren't used to that stuff.
He ain't used to a lot of things,
Sadie said, shoving the bottle toward him on the tray.
He ain't used to the idea he's not going to be governor. Are you, Willie?